This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 4 years ago, reporter Malcolm Garcia went to cover the war in Afghanistan. In Kabul, he struck up a special relationship with a group of orphans who hustled a living on the streets. Garcia bought lunch for the boys, helped them enroll in a school for orphans. He even let them stick around sometimes when he conducted interviews. Like a lot of the journalists in Afghanistan in those days, Malcolm left to report on the invasion of Iraq. But he never forgot those five boys and the implicit promises he came to believe he'd made to them. Last year, Garcia returned to Afghanistan to search for the young friends he'd left behind. Malcolm Garcia joins us in just a minute to talk about those boys and about what he describes as simmering anger and hopelessness in Afghanistan. And we want to hear from you. If you've been to Afghanistan, call us and tell us what you saw. Or if you want to talk to Malcolm about his experiences, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Malcolm Garcia is a reporter for the Kansas City Star. His piece, All the Country Will Be Shaking, appears in the Virginia Quarterly Review, and he joins us now from a studio in Little Rock, Arkansas. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And tell us a little bit about those boys and the promises that you thought you'd made to them.
I met the boys in 2003 when I went to Afghanistan at the start of the Iraq war. I was asked to cover what was happening in Afghanistan, and they parked themselves outside the hotel I was at, and they caught my attention because they would ask you for money, and then when you said no, they left you alone, whereas most of the street children would just be on you like white on rice, and you had to really kind of try to shake them off. And it really just started very slowly. I started buying them candy because I wouldn't give them money. I'd say, I'll buy you candy. And then for no particular reason, it was really just serendipity. One afternoon when I had some time, I invited them to lunch. And they told me that they felt very guilty about eating so much because their families were going hungry. And that touched me. And they also talked about wanting to go to school. And I knew of a school that specialized in educating homeless kids. So I took them to the school. We got them enrolled. And then, I sort of took on the role of a parent, an Afghan colleague. And we began, we'd tutor them at night, make sure they did their homework. And we really gave them expectations. They got excited. They began to have dreams. They started talking about the things that they wanted to do. And then 4 months later, I left, and I told them I'd come back, but I really didn't believe it at the time. I didn't know what was in store for me in terms of other assignments, and I always felt that I had given them expectations but had left them no place to go. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that my relationship with the boys was, in a sense, a metaphor for the world's relationship with Afghanistan. We go in, we promise a lot, and then we leave. And last spring, when the Taliban was making inroads very close to Kabul, I decided I needed to go back and find the boys.
There's a point during your search for them, you're carrying pictures that are obviously 4 years old at that point, of the boys and trying to locate one. And you talk to a man who says, why these boys? There are thousands like them here on the streets of Kabul. Why don't you help them?
Right. Yeah. And actually, I even had adults who would stop me and say, why children? I need help. And I just explained that I had made a commitment to these boys and that I had to find these boys, that it was something I had to do for myself as much as I had to do for them. And that's why I was focused on that particular group of children.
You also describe in the process of your search Kabul greatly changed from 4 years ago.
It was. Kabul is somewhat of an illusion. On the surface, there's all sorts of construction going on. They have malls now. You can buy widescreen TVs. But beneath the surface, there's a real anger because, again, to use the metaphor, as the boys had expectations of me, so the country had expectations of the United States and the international coalition. And 5 years later, or 6 years later, many people feel their life hasn't improved. And they see you know, people driving around in SUVs, they see the large houses that aid agencies rent and that private security firms rent, and they just see a great disparity between the Westerners who are there, who they feel should be helping them, and what they feel is the result of their presence, which many people just feel isn't that much.
There's a wonderful scene you paint. You and your translator go into a restaurant in one of these sort of gated communities, and there are a bunch of other people who were brought in by their Afghan drivers. The drivers, regarded as security risks, are asked to remain outside. They can't come inside.
Right, and that you see that a lot. And, you know, it's the awkward situation of working with people who, and in many instances, you don't know who is friend or foe. And as a result, it may not be the intent, but you give the impression of an occupation. And that's what my colleague said to me, that when you tell Afghan people they can't walk down particular streets where there are Western embassies or Western businesses, or you can't go into a particular restaurant because it's for Westerners and security, it gives the impression that the coalition is occupying the country, which then takes away the veneer that they're there really to help rebuild and then turn the country over.
You also take a trip outside of Kabul, against the advice of your translator and driver, to go down to another place to look for the boys on a newly paved highway. So there is some reconstruction going on.
Oh, absolutely. You can see improvements. But as one international aid worker told me, said the successes are not proportional to the amount of money pouring into the country. So the road from Kabul to Jalalabad is paved, and it's wonderful. It takes about 2 hours now, whereas before it took 5 to 6 hours. But those kind of improvements aren't, you don't see them consistently. And even when there's an improvement, as we show in the story, you might be able to get from one place or another, but it's very dangerous because of the insurgency.
And indeed, a lot of the people, there's another one conversation that you write about, a man you approach, I think, down in Jalalabad, in fact, who said, I just hope that when you find these boys, that they're going to be picked, they will have picked up a Kalashnikov and be on the other side now.
Right. I mean, the people are very upset. In that situation, I was talking to farmers who'd had their poppy crop destroyed, but poppy is the crop where they can really make money, and so you destroy the crop. There aren't alternatives for them to pursue. You get very angry, and that anger is widespread. And so yes, people were pretty candid with me about either suggesting the boys get guns or that they probably have already joined the insurgency and I shouldn't bother looking for them.
We're talking with reporter Malcolm Garcia about his story, All the Country Will Be Shaking, which was featured in the Virginia Quarterly Review. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's get Mitch on the line. Mitch with us from Chicago.
Yes. My question is, I mean, morally objectionable as we might find it, aren't we reaching the point where we're causing more trouble than good by trying to save and don't save these countries? Don't we just have to realize and maybe just walk away and say, hey, look, you know, Afghans are going to have to solve their own problems? I realize we set up some of the problems, but by us staying there, don't we just exacerbate and irritate what's ultimately need to be fought out and figured out by Afghans themselves?
What do you think, Malcolm Garcia?
Well, I think that we should really follow the suggestion of the International Committee for the Red Cross, which last June called for massive amounts of emergency humanitarian aid to help Afghanistan get back on its feet. I think if we follow that procedure, you would give hope to the country. People would see a reason not to join the insurgency, but to pursue goals that would actually have outcomes. There would be jobs which would promote income, which therefore, you know, could help them improve their lives. And I think if we want
to follow up,
if you keep it short.
Okay, just very quickly, but don't by the security we bring in to support that aid, don't we just keep a war footing going?
Well, Malcolm Garcia, Afghanistan has been at war one way or another for the past 20 years.
Yeah, no, it's been at war with itself. I think, you know, the other part of the problem, and we're playing Monday morning quarterback, is the pace of change that we put the country through. At the time of the various elections that led to Karzai's election in 04, there are a lot of voices saying we need to slow this down, that we're moving too fast to get this election when we don't have the infrastructure in place that would make this a meaningful government. So I think there's still time where our presence can be seen as a good thing, providing that they see outcomes from our presence, whereas right now many of the people that I spoke to don't see that outcome.
Mitch, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And eventually, I don't want to give your story away, but eventually you do find some of the boys that you met all those years ago. And had they taken up guns? Were they on the side? What were they doing?
No, I found three out of the five. Two were selling cassettes, and one was selling tea on the street. And they're earning about $1 a day. And they weren't in school anymore because they said they had to earn that dollar a day to help feed their family so they couldn't go to school, which is another problem that Afghanistan faces, the prevalence of child labor, such a strong prevalence of children on the street working, begging, you know, selling tea as these boys are doing, is creating a generation of illiterate Afghans who will then be, you know, ripe for the picking for people who are opposed to the U.S. presence.
We're talking with Malcolm Garcia, a reporter for the Kansas City Star, whose piece All the Country Will Be Shaking appears in the Virginia Quarterly Review. More with him coming up. Also, we'll talk about Canada, one country that's reexamining its role in Afghanistan. And more of your calls, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Afghanistan for much of this hour. It's 4 years after the Democratic election that raised hopes for that country, hopes that have remained in many areas unfulfilled. Our guest is Malcolm Garcia, a reporter for the Kansas City Star, who wrote a long piece about his most recent visit to Afghanistan that appeared in the Virginia Quarterly Review. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with a Canadian expert who testified before an independent panel in that country about the future of its role in Afghanistan. If you have questions about the country and about the Canadian contribution to the situation there, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Gary. Gary calling from Philadelphia.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Garcia. Question for you. By your own admission, the insurgency is increasing dramatically in Afghanistan. And that's directly related to the growth of the poppy crop. In 2004, we had about 100,000 hectares. This year, we're having 200,000 hectares with a farm gate of about $1 billion. And yet, all your reporters come in there and say that if we eliminate the poppy crop, we're going to hurt the country. But if we don't do something dramatically with that, we're going to see a more increase of insurgency based on the fact that they take 10% or this year almost $100 million.
And not to mention the misery of those who get hooked on heroin. But anyway.
Exactly. You have that, and then you're having tremendous problems with the refugees coming in with the huge volume of opium also that they're abusing over there. It's a terrible problem, and it doesn't seem like anybody wants to confront that problem. I'd just like to get your opinion on that.
Well, I think you make good points. And to tackle it effectively, we have to do more than simply burning the fields and not leaving the farmers with anything without an alternative. And that's what's been missing. There needs to be an alternative. And I doubt they'd ever find an alternative that would pay as well as poppies. But money isn't the sole thing. I think if people had an alternative that would give them security, would give them a sense of a future, would give them a sense of investment in the country, they would pursue that alternative, particularly because it would be a peaceful alternative. It's dangerous to be a farmer growing poppies. They get ripped off by the buyers, etc. So what's been missing is that we're taking, but we're not offering something back with the other hand.
Joining us now from CBC Studios in Ottawa is Roland Paris. He testified before an independent panel on Afghanistan who made recommendations to the Canadian government on how to proceed with the Canadian mission in Afghanistan. Roland Paris is Associate Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa, and welcome to Talk of the Nation today.
Thanks very much, Neil.
And tell us a little bit about this independent panel.
Well, Canada has had forces in Afghanistan since 2002, and more recently Canada has been primarily responsible for the security of Kandahar province in the southern part of the country. That commitment Canada made to remain in Kandahar with its battle group through to the end of February 2009, it's been very controversial in this country as to what would happen when 2009 comes up, whether Canada will continue, whether it will withdraw, whether it will move into some other function. So the government of Canada created a nonpartisan task force, a kind of light version of the Iraq Study Group, to make recommendations. And that group reported last week, and their report caused quite a stir because they essentially said that the situation in southern Afghanistan is deteriorating, that unless there are NATO reinforcements and a strategic rethinking in Afghanistan, southern Afghanistan, that the mission risks failing, and that Canada should only agree to continue its presence of military forces in southern Afghanistan if NATO basically gets its act together and reinforces, sends additional combat troops to southern Afghanistan to deal with this security situation, which has been deteriorating since 2005.
Or else?
Or else, according to the report, now these are recommendations from an independent group, but the group recommends that Canada indicate that it will withdraw its forces, its combat forces, from Kandahar if NATO is unable to reinforce the Canadians by February 2009.
Kandahar, of course, was the home of the Taliban. Their base of support is one of the most dangerous areas in Afghanistan, and the Canadians, I know, feel that they've gotten enough notice for what they've done or credit for what they've accomplished.
I think that that's right. There's a great deal of frustration in this country with the sense that that here we are doing our share as a member of an alliance, yet there are very few members of NATO who seem willing to consider deploying their forces to southern Afghanistan. And I think the fear in this country is that Canadian troops could end up being locked into this primary role in the most strategically important and unstable part of Afghanistan, that is Kandahar, without adequate support from our allies. And that is, I think, the rationale for this, in effect, what is the recommendation that Canada deliver a kind of public-spirited ultimatum to NATO to get its act together or we won't stick around.
And yet the other side of that ultimatum is, yes, the situation's deteriorating and we're going to pull out.
That's right, except that I think that this task force, which reported, also made a point of saying that the situation isn't hopeless, and also that that the success of the overall international effort in Afghanistan is important for international security, regional security, and perhaps more to the point, for ultimately for Canadian national security interests too. So they're not suggesting abandoning the mission, but they are, in a sense, calling on NATO as a whole to get its act together and saying that Canada shouldn't be willing to continue putting its forces in a potentially a losing situation if NATO can't at least get its act together to send an additional 1,000 troops to Kandahar by next February.
So you see this as a shot across NATO's bow, and you're not, Canada's not the only people appealing to NATO for more troops for Afghanistan. The United States has made it pretty clear that it would like NATO to send more forces to Afghanistan too.
It is intended, I think, to be a shot across NATO's bow. It's worth emphasizing that that the government of Canada is still considering the recommendations, excuse me, in the task force report. And one of the reasons that this debate is so vexing within Canada right now is that the current government is a minority government in the parliament, and there's a great deal of disagreement among the various parties on what Canada should do after February 2009. So there needs to be, and there is a debate, and there needs to be an in a sense, a negotiation between the government and especially the leading opposition party in order to determine what the Canadian position on Afghanistan post February 2009 will ultimately be. That's still in motion.
As of yesterday, I think 78 Canadian soldiers and one diplomat have died in Afghanistan, which is, of course, deplorable. But looking at it from the vantage point of the United States, which has, of course, had many more troops and many more casualties, is it time? Why is this so unpopular in Canada?
Well, I mean, it's a very difficult question for me to answer, and I should say that I lived myself in the United States for 10 years until 2000 and the end of 2003. So I'm acutely aware of the circumstances, the debate within the United States surrounding both Afghanistan and at least the beginning of the Iraq War. Very different here. This combat operation for Canada in Afghanistan is the first real combat operation that Canadian troops have been involved in since the Korean War. This country has not for decades been in a situation where its troops have been involved in real combat. For Canadians, the primary role over the last few decades of the armed forces internationally has been, in the mind of Canadians at least, peacekeeping, where there have been casualties but under very different circumstances. So there is a strong strand of public opinion in this country that's quite uncomfortable with the combat role to begin with, but even among those who are comfortable with the role that Canada has been playing, there's concerns about drift in this mission and about whether Canada is out there out front, while the United States has effectively treated this as an economy of force mission and been distracted by what's been going on in Iraq.
If you had a guess, what would you hazard?
It's very difficult to say. What will happen now over the next days and weeks is that the government and the main opposition party will negotiate and see if they can come out with a common position. The opposition party's current position is that it wants Canada to stop combat operations in February 2009. They might be willing to consider an extension, but I think they would ultimately want to have a date where they knew that Canada would be replaced and would rotate to maybe to some other part of Afghanistan, be replaced by an alliance by another alliance member. If there is an agreement, then it'll probably be on that kind of basis, an extension, but with an end date where Canada will do something else in Afghanistan. If there isn't an agreement, that given that this is a minority parliament, it's possible that this could trigger an election in this country.
Roland Paris, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Roland Paris is an associate professor of public and international affairs at the University of Ottawa, and he joined us from CBC Studios in Ottawa. Well, Malcolm Garcia is still with us, and we're still taking more of your calls about his visit to Afghanistan and yours if you've been there. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And let's go to Chicago and to Bronislav. Bronislav, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for Mr. Garcia. A friend of ours traveled quite extensively throughout Afghanistan in the 1970s as an American citizen with his wife, and he was welcomed pretty much everywhere he went. There were pictures or photographs of John F. Kennedy in every little shack or shanty that he stopped in. I'm curious as to Mr. Garcia's opinion as to how did we get from that to this within such a brief period of time?
Well, I think in part, after the Soviet Union left Afghanistan in 89, we in effect left Afghanistan also. We were helping the Afghans fighting the Soviet Union, but we didn't stay to participate in the rebuilding. When we went in 2001, the Afghans, you know, were joyous. I mean, that's a gross understatement. They were, you know, they beside themselves and very pleased to see us. But I think, again, we dropped the ball in terms of pursuing reconstruction in such a way that they would see tangible and consistent progress in a timely manner. Perceptions aren't fact, but they're real. And the perception now in Afghanistan is that we've been there for a very long time and haven't done a whole lot.
You write, in fact, that in some sort of historical rearrangement, Afghans now blame the West, and particularly the United States, for all of their problems going back to the Soviet invasion.
No, that was a very surprising moment in Jalalabad when people were talking to me. And, you know, when I first arrived in Afghanistan in 2001, nobody had anything good to say about the Taliban or the Soviet Union's occupation. And now suddenly, you know, history is being rewritten because of the disillusionment. The Soviets are being praised for what they did. The Taliban's being praised for having brought security to the country. And the international coalition is just being maligned, along with Karzai. He's being roped into that as well, and he's losing legitimacy in the eyes of the country.
Bronislav, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with Malcolm Garcia. His article, All the Country Will Be Shaking, appeared in the Virginia Quarterly Review, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get, this is John in Glenwood, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much. I'm a former Peace Corps volunteer. I was in Afghanistan then in the 1960s, and I've returned several times since working in international assistance and humanitarian assistance in Afghanistan. What I've seen and what gives rise to much of the problem that we're seeing right now, that is the rise of the Taliban, is the fact that we're attacking a security problem that is our definition of the security problem in Afghanistan. In reality, the Afghans, as Malcolm so clearly described, identify their own security needs. Those security needs are things that make it possible for people to live and survive in their communities, in their villages, in the towns and cities. Basically, security needs that they have are things related to address the corruption issues, address the problems with the warlords, address the problems of no local opportunities at the community level, that kind of things. Those are the problems that we have not addressed adequately in Afghanistan.
Would you agree, Malcolm?
That have given rise to the Taliban resurgence.
I would. I think that's an excellent point, and it gets back to the need to not only identify problems but have a commitment to solve those problems in a manner that people are involved in and can see tangible results in a timely manner. It doesn't mean that, you know, they have to see a result tomorrow, but there has to be a sense of progress, and that's what they're not seeing that now. The road to Jalalabad is great, but that's that sort of pops up and nothing else happens. Then something else pops up, people are happy, then nothing else happens. There needs to be a consistency in the rebuilding to give people a sense that they're part of a new Afghanistan.
Yeah, and if I could make one more point, we know how to do the kind of assistance that Afghanistan needs. We did it, we learned how to do it, really, in helping to the former republics of the Soviet Union become independent states in Eastern Europe, in Central Asia to some degree. We know how to do this, but we're not, under this present administration, being allowed to do that properly. Unfortunately, the assistance that we're providing to Afghanistan is of the top-down variety that does not get down to the village. It's an enormous amount of money. But again, as Malcolm again stated, you know, it is not proportionate. That is, the benefit to the Afghans in the village is not even close to proportionate enough to the amount of money that we're spending. Look at the amount that we spend on the military.
John, excuse me, I don't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to get another question for Malcolm before we have to go. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
This is Melinda on our blog asking, Mr. Garcia, would you again get involved, and what was the benefit of your help to those children?
Well, the benefit was that someone took an interest in them. You know, the downside was when I left, in a way, you know, I'm sure they felt abandoned. Just again, metaphorically, the country as a whole feels abandoned. But since I found them and got back involved with them, it was a way of telling them that I hadn't forgotten them, that I hadn't abandoned them, and that now I'll be back in their lives and I'll stay in touch and visit with them and send money and do what I can so that you know, my efforts at rebuilding will be more consistent and timely than they were before.
Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We wish you and them the best luck. Malcolm Garcia is a writer for the Kansas City Star and wrote an article called All the Country Will Be Shaking in the Virginia Quarterly Review. Coming up, picking the music to underscore your message is a delicate business for presidential candidates. Carrie Brownstein, former guitarist and songwriter, has some expert advice on the topic and will take your suggestions. What music do you think the campaigns should play? Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News.